Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bektesh.
And I'm Barbara Platts. The town of Basalt is hearing from its citizens and working to comply with open records requests.
Jazz Aspen Snowmass's Labor Day experience starts tomorrow. Hear from the man behind the music.
Bears and lions are being killed in an effort to increase deer hunting permits.
And a volunteer board in Aspen can overrule elected officials.
All that and more news coming up on Mountain Edition.
After listening to a variety of comments from the public Tuesday night on how to develop a key piece of property along the Roaring Fork River, the Basalt Town Council agreed to scale its plans back. Two questions will be on this November's ballot to decide how the Pan and Fork property should be developed. One will ask Basalt voters if they want to buy a parcel currently owned by a development corporation that the town is eyeing for $3 million. The other question will ask voters to approve $4 million in park improvements. The park improvements are part of what is being called a base level design and is dramatically less than what was originally planned. The plan includes a bandshell and public restrooms. The bonds would be paid back with property and sales tax revenues. Council is hoping to take advantage of historically low interest rates on bonds. Additionally, open space funds from Pickens and Eagle counties also may be used. Council is scheduled to formally approve the ballot language at its September 6th meeting.
Also in Basalt, claims of a lack of government transparency have led to a surge of requests for public documents. Carolyn Zachariasen reports.
Town Clerk Pam Schilling has about a dozen requests by citizens and journalists for information filed under the Colorado Open Records Act. By law, she has 3 days to provide those public documents. But because she is inundated with so many requests at once, she informed some individuals earlier this week that it's going to take longer to assemble the public documents. That's the case for Basalt resident Ted Guy, who last week asked for all writings between the mayor, a council member, and the former town manager since July, as well as text messages by the mayor since August, public notices for specific government meetings, and audio recordings of executive sessions. That takes a lot of time, Schilling says.
Well, it does affect everyone who has to pull their emails, the planning department, finance. So a good number of staff is affected by this, by these requests.
She says providing public documents under CORA oftentimes involves hundreds of pieces of paper and countless hours of work. That's why the town of Basalt, like many other municipalities, charged 25 cents a page and $30 an hour for staff time. The first hour is free. The town clerk says a sudden uptick in requests started around the April election, when a criminal investigation was opened over a citizen's request for the mayor's text messages. Carolyn Zachariasen, Aspen Public Radio News.
Aspen Films Film Fest lineup was announced Tuesday. Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort reports.
Four films are making their United States debut at next month's Aspen Film Film Fest. It opens with Certain Women, which premiered at Sundance. It features Michelle Williams, Kristen Stewart, and Laura Dern in a portrayal of the intersection of their lives in Montana. Aspen Film Executive Director John Thew says he's excited to start the festival with a film of that caliber. Another movie, The Last Laugh, explores the line between dark comedy and plain bad taste. 20 movies are being shown during the multi-day festival, all of them making their Colorado debut. The films are being screened at the Wheeler Opera House and the Crystal Theater starting on September 21st. Patrick Fort at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
The farmers market in Basalt now accepts payment through a government-funded food assistance program. Allison was at the market over the weekend to find out more about the program.
Basalt Sunday Market manager Jimmy Dula has expanded what's known as SNAP, short for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. There are few healthy options for residents who are food insecure. Food banks often carry canned products or high-calorie, low-nutrition boxed items. Dula says even grocery store produce has often traveled so far before it hits the shelves that it is no longer at the height of nutrition.
Obesity is just as big of a problem as hunger is. We have a long way to go.
SNAP clients can check in at the market booth and use their EBT card, formerly known as food stamps, to trade program credits for market bucks. Dula hopes that along with providing healthier food options to shoppers, the program will also increase sales for local farmers. Erin Cusio of Erin's Acres says she hasn't always had the means to include fresh produce in her grocery shopping. She is aware that farmers markets can be cost prohibitive and works to keep the prices of her own produce down.
I don't feel like I'm increasing access by having prices that are out of the budget for a lot of people.
She says accepting SNAP credits is a great tool for creating that access. Dula says his next mission is to increase the diversity of the market and partner with organizations that can help with inclusion and transportation for those who need it.
The alternative food system has tended to create spaces of whiteness, and that's exactly what's happening at the Basalt Sunday Market. So are we creating a space that everyone feels welcome to come shop at?
The market runs through the end of September. Next year, SNAP credits will be doubled. Patrons can trade one SNAP dollar for two market bucks.
Two proposed initiatives that would increase regulations on fracking failed to make the Colorado ballot. Aspen Public Radio's Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports.
The initiatives would have allowed for more local control and required a 2,500-foot setback from any occupied building. The Colorado Secretary of State's office reported that the petitions only garnered about 80% of the necessary signatures. Doug Saxton, co-chair of the group Battlement Concerned Citizens, says this is a major setback for members of his group who have been working to prevent drilling in their neighborhood. Saxton is particularly disappointed that the setback question won't be on the ballot.
That would have been like a silver bullet. But, you know, we'll still be looking for other remedies like new rules or new legislation.
The state recently approved one well pad in a Battlement Mesa subdivision and is considering another. There is no set timeline for that decision. Elizabeth Stewart Severy from the Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk. This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
In a closed executive session on Monday, the Aspen Valley Hospital Board of Directors solidified a contract bringing Dave Ressler back as chief executive officer.
Hospital officials were initially hesitant to release Ressler's taxpayer-provided compensation, but when asked, he acknowledged that it's public information. His base salary is $402,000 a year. He and his wife will also move into hospital-provided housing. Ressler left the CEO position at AVH in 2013. Since then, he has led the nonprofit Community Care Alliance and spent much of his time in rural hospital districts. He says he is now much more familiar with what works and doesn't in hospitals such as Aspen's.
I think sometimes it's hard to think of Aspen as rural. It is by the definition of its distance from the next closest facility and market, and it is a small population.
Ressler's first official day is Monday, September 26th, though he will begin meeting with staff and board members before then. The budget process for 2017 will get underway as soon as he begins.
Mule deer may seem ubiquitous in the Roaring Fork Valley, but Colorado Parks and Wildlife says numbers of the species are below its target in some key areas near Rifle. The state agency plans to kill mountain lions and bears in an effort to help grow the deer population, Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports.
The so-called predator control study would last 3 years, beginning next spring. Colorado Parks and Wildlife, or CPW, has contracted with a federal agency called Wildlife Services, which will trap and kill between 5 and 10 mountain lions and 10 to 20 bears annually on the Rhone Plateau outside of Rifle. CPW wildlife biologist Chuck Anderson says the goal is to drop the number of young fawns killed by bears and mountain lions. The predator study comes after years of studying habitat fragmentation caused by oil and gas development in the area, which is no longer seen as a limiting factor.
Basically, there's nothing showing us that there's any evidence of habitat limitations in this population. And the forage conditions are good. We've been doing some habitat improvement projects in the area, and the vegetation's responded very well.
But still, Anderson says the deer population is below the goal set by CPW, and that mountain lions and black bears may be to blame. This may come as a surprise to those used to seeing Bruins focused on acorns, berries, and trash.
Actually, bears are very efficient predators of young ungulates, both elk and deer. And actually, the highest mortality rates I have in deer in the Piceance are from black bears. Um, so so far, we're averaging about 14% of the fawns that we collar each year are taken by black bears.
So why is CPW concerned with a prey species being eaten by its natural predators? Anderson explains that it's as much about recreational hunting as it is about ecology.
Mule deer are somewhat of the iconic species of the West. They're a very valued game species, obviously. There's strong economic incentive for having healthy deer populations.
Critics of this type of study say that motivation is exactly the problem. And by killing predators to increase their prey, CPW would disrupt a complex system and fragile social structure. Wendy Kiefover is a native carnivore protection manager at the Humane Society. She says the study is unnecessary, and removing established adult mountain lions may have unintended consequences. Younger males may become more aggressive to assert dominance.
May potentially increase predation initially of mule deer and even create more conflicts between humans and livestock.
Anderson says it's difficult to track numbers of predators like bears and mountain lions, so the agency can't say what percentage of those animals will be killed. But he says those populations rebound quickly. He claims this is a small-scale study dealing with unique circumstances.
Again, this is not a large-scale thing. In fact, it's been pretty well demonstrated that large-scale predator reduction efforts are not very successful.
Although CPW says this is a focused study that targets lions and bears in a relatively small area, Kiefover is concerned about how those animal populations will recover.
Both those animals have a really hard time in a human-dominated landscape surviving to adulthood and then reproducing themselves successfully.
If the proposed study gets final approval from the state, the killing of bears and lions will happen in the spring when there is no hunting season for those species. Wildlife Services, an arm of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, will capture the predators using cage traps, hounds, and potentially even foot snares, and then shoot the animals. David Moreno, wildlife biologist for the agency, says the meat will be donated and the hides become state property. The next informational meeting is scheduled for September 19th in Denver. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy from the Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The Downtowner, the electric shuttle that offers rides in Aspen, will be running through the off-season and this winter. Barbara took a ride in one with Mike Fisher, operations manager for the Downtowner, and city parking director Mitch Osier.
Can you speak a little to the success this summer?
Yeah, well, I think the success is a couple different things. Number one is it's free. Let's be honest, it's free, and the expectation is that we tip the driver. So when you do something in a town like this and it's free, how could it not be successful? Plus, people in this town want to do the right thing. I mean, we worked hard to make sure that we asked for specifically electric vehicles. Nothing's better than zero emission vehicle that can drive around town.
What kind of person is taking this? Is it tourists? Is it locals?
We get absolutely everything across the board, from kids who just want to go hang out with their friends at the skate park, to elderly people who have trouble walking with their groceries. We have groups that ride religiously on their days off to go for happy hour and drinks. We literally get everything across the spectrum.
But certainly we were taking tourists, but I think versus other cities where they've been at, that there's more locals taking this on a regular basis, which was kind of one of our goals. It's fantastic.
Can you see a direct link between people using this and not parking in town?
Absolutely. When we put this together and we dealt with the Downtowner team, we sort of put a 4 or 5 prong program together to help reduce congestion and parking in town. The Downtowner one was one of those. In addition, we raised parking prices, as most people know. The prices are going back down on September 1st, which is Thursday, but we did raise prices 50%. With that, we have averaged about 13% less cars parking in the core this summer versus last summer.
Can you speak a little to how you're going to outfit these guys for the winter?
Sure. Three things we're doing. One is Mike has already ordered snow tires for these. So we'll have snow tires on all 5 vehicles. And we're going to put heaters in here. And then we'll also outfit the back with the ability to carry skis.
So for you, Mike, and kind of for other drivers, is this something that can be a full-time job?
It depends on what you're doing and how you live your life. But I do know that there are 2 drivers with us who do this full-time. This is their only source of income. And this is what they do to pay the bills.
And Mike, because you've implemented this in other towns, how's Aspen different?
I would say that Aspen is different in the best way humanly possible. We have never seen a location pick up in the sense that Aspen has. And we've only been open for 3 months, and there's days where we're rivaling some of our other larger locations. I honestly don't think this could have gotten any better than the way it's gone so far here.
Thanks again, guys.
Hey, our pleasure.
That was Parking Director Mitch Osier and Mike Fisher, Operations Manager for the Downtowner. To get more details and hear the full conversation, go to aspenpublicradio.org.
Morgan Williams, the fourth and fifth grade teacher at Glenwood Springs Two Rivers Community School, took his students on a multidisciplinary field trip last week. An adventure at the South Canyon landfill served as an environmental lesson, as well as an opportunity to work on writing. Allison tagged along and brings us this report.
Woo-hoo! All right, come on off!
One by one, the kids file off the school bus at the top of the trash heap. Their heads are tucked down into their shirts, hiding their noses from the surrounding stench.
It smells really bad.
It smells like dirty diapers.
It's really gross.
It is.
King Lloyd is the landfill superintendent, or as his staff affectionately call him, the king of trash.
The lord of the landfill.
The students gather around Lloyd as he gives a history of the landfill. Not only is it smelly, it's also starting to rain. But the kids are enthralled as a large truck carrying construction debris dips its cargo onto the top of the landfill pile. Along with learning about trash, recycling, composting, and reusing, the students are also learning analytical thinking skills. In the classroom, Williams asked his class to summarize what they've learned.
110 to 120 tons of trash enter the landfill every day.
And what we should do is reduce, reuse, recycle, because it is a responsible thing to do.
The Glenwood Springs landfill is unique. Not many municipalities manage their own trash. It's mostly a county task. Unlike Pitkin County Landfill's imminent end of life, South Canyon has about 50 years remaining. This week, the trash pile will move over into a natural basin tucked up against the mountain range. That hole will be filled in about 8 months, then it's over to the next basin. In about a decade, the landfill will expand vertically. What are now individual peaks will someday be filled in to make one flat butte, a literal mountain of trash. Lloyd tells the students, to extend the life of the landfill, South Canyon also has on-site recycling and composting. What do you see in these piles?
A lot of plastic, a lot of dirt. There's some glass right there. And I didn't think that you could compost glass.
So sometimes people just aren't very careful, it seems like, where they put their stuff.
They're lazy or they accidentally do that. So,
the entire landfill operation is a little ecosystem of reuse and upcycling, or the repurposing of trash. Scrap metal is sorted out, crushed into big cubes, and taken to Denver, where it can be sold. Concrete is crushed down and used for traction in the winter, when the landfill's roads become icy. Tires and mattresses are shredded, and that's placed on top of the trash pile periodically, helping to cover the garbage, to keep it in place, and act as a barrier against wildlife. This week, the students themselves are learning about upcycling by using trash to create wearable items for a fashion show. The field trip taught the kids that everyone needs to think more about where their trash goes, as they explained back in the classroom.
I hope that you learned that the landfill will overflow if we don't do something about it. So please try to recycle and stop throwing away things that can be recycled or upcycled.
Thank you for listening to the Two Rivers Community School Report.
Can I clap now?
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Barbara Platts. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Also online, you can sign up for Aspen Public Radio's new ForkFed digital newsletter. ForkFed comes out every Friday, updating you on the week's news in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond.
The city of Aspen is dipping its toes into the realm of food security and is encouraging residents to grow their own vegetables and herbs. What is the role of local government in food? Elizabeth Stewart-Severy reports from the garden behind City Hall in Aspen.
Aspen sits in the heart of the arid West, and as soon as the snow flies, at the end of a dead-end valley when Independence Pass closes. Ashley Pearl, who works for the city's Environmental Health Department, explains that Aspen's geography creates some vulnerabilities in the food shed, as was exposed last year when a rock slide closed Glenwood Canyon in February.
If you went to the market a day after the rock slide, the shelves were bare. Like, quite literally, I think I got the last package of chicken. And it happened in the winter, worst case scenario, when we're not growing anything here anyway.
Pearl is standing above the municipal government's own vegetable garden, tucked neatly behind City Hall in the middle of the downtown core. She's part of an informal group that has started to dig into what it means for the Aspen community to develop more food security. And for Pearl, it starts with small gardens like this one. The food security group is encouraging locals and businesses to convert 25% of their flower gardens to vegetables. They handed out seed packets and information about how to grow food in our somewhat urban landscape and hosted a veggie garden competition this summer. Pearl explains that some of the small city planters around town have hidden, sometimes unusual, veggies.
You're walking by, you're inspired by how beautiful Aspen looks in the summer, and then you go, oh my goodness, is that an artichoke? We had a lot of people say, I didn't even know you could grow artichokes.
This area does have a short growing season, but one of the biggest challenges for the food security group has been identifying ways that local governments can help people get involved in food production, from commercial baking to small gardens. Aspen's community garden recently added 26 new plots, and local gardener Candace Oxenhorn says this provides important space to grow organic foods.
Our environment gives us what we need.
Oxenhorn has planted various greens, turnips, potatoes, and much more, but she says it's more about learning and experimenting.
At first, I was like always worried about doing it perfectly, and this year I'm just sort of like, wow, like I'm just going to enjoy this, and whatever grows is good.
The food security team will soon make suggestions about how to expand agriculture on other city properties, like Cozy Point Open Space. Pearl says she would like to see an incubator approach in which inexperienced farmers can learn from experts. The draft management plan for Cozy Point is expected in the next several weeks, with agricultural bids to follow. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy from the Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Aspen's Historic Preservation Commission is a volunteer board with a lot of power.
The HPC reviews about 50 projects a year. Big developments in 2016 that the group has seen include a new public safety building for Aspen Police, St. Mary's Church expansion, and an expansion of the Aspen Meadows reception area. In 2014, the commission approved a handful of projects from prominent landlord Mark Hunt. Willis Pember is the chair of the commission. Speaking in his architecture office, he says the name of the commission is misleading. It is not their intent to make sure all development looks historic.
And the theory there is, you know, it leads to a certain Disneyfication if you're mimicking and aping what has gone on in the past. And I think a lot of people see the board, just by virtue of our name, as upholding traditional values in design. And that's not generally the case.
Amy Simon is the historic preservation officer for the city. She says Aspen's genuine history sets it apart from other Colorado resort towns. And that's apparent through all the eras of architecture still present today.
There's lots of ski resorts they could go to that were built 10 years ago. You're not going to have the same experience. And same for all of us living here. It makes a huge difference to be in a place that has that kind of personality, and it's a great place to live.
The HBC only looks at exterior design. It can't keep someone from gutting a historic home. Projects that seek variances from the land use code go before the Planning and Zoning Commission and City Council. But if no variances are needed, the final stop is HPC. So Hunt's potential to change downtown Aspen is in the hands of these seven citizens. Though City Council members can put in their 2 cents. This past spring, the commission went head-to-head with the Aspen City Council over St. Mary's Church's development plans. The council was not happy with HPC's approval of an 8,000-foot expansion and asked that the commission reconsider. The council does not get the final call, though, and the members of HPC held strong with their approval. The council does, however, decide who is on the commission. Citizens volunteer and are interviewed and assigned by council. The majority of the commission are designers and developers themselves. Simon says this is a benefit, not a conflict of interest.
We need to know what we're doing when making these decisions. We need to have people on the board who are very knowledgeable about construction, architecture. It's important.
The historic preservation guidelines are currently going through an overhaul. HPC will have its first discussion on that Wednesday, September 7th at 4:30 p.m. at City Hall.
For more than 25 years, Jim Horowitz has been putting on some of the biggest music events in the Roaring Fork Valley. The signature event, the Jazz Aspen Snowmass Labor Day Experience, begins tomorrow afternoon. Aspen Public Radio's arts reporter Patrick Fort has this profile of the man who spent his career making music and bringing world-class artists here.
Jim Horowitz was the son of two New Yorkers, and after the Second World War, his parents moved the family to South Florida, where they had a successful restaurant business called Junior's.
And they served, at its height, 20,000 people in a day from 7 in the morning. This is not a joke. The restaurant seated 500 people, and there was always a line out the door.
He helped out around the restaurant occasionally as a kid. He also was teaching himself how to play the piano. He begged and begged for his parents to buy him one, and after a while, he was finally successful. His parents tried to put him into lessons.
I played, and then there were piano teachers, but the piano teachers couldn't really handle me because I didn't want to read. I just wanted to play what I heard.
And he did that all through high school and college, where he studied political science and became a paralegal for a civil rights law firm in Washington. He worked there until one day his neighbor came knocking on his door. This woman, Ruby, had heard that Horowitz played the piano.
For whatever reason, you know, she liked me and I was just a neighbor, and she just started knocking on the door and said, why don't you come and I want to rehearse. I want to get an act together with jazz and blues. And I was like, I play Beatles music. I don't really know anything about jazz and blues. Plus, I work for a lawyer. But she wouldn't. She was very persistent. I don't know why.
So one night, he went to play some music with Ruby. It was Billie Holiday. She played a record for him, one of Holiday's hits. Play it again, Jim said. And soon enough, they were playing jazz standards in Ruby's basement.
Them that's got shall have. Them that's not shall lose. So the Bible...
Within weeks, they were gigging in our nation's capital. But after years of performing and teaching opportunities in D.C., he felt like he wasn't growing anymore. He wanted to try something different and get into the business side of things. After a trip to a jazz festival in France, he knew the perfect place to start his own music event, a place where his parents vacationed when he was a child, Aspen. The first step, find a venue.
The original thing was just to go to the Aspen Music Festival and say, hey, how about having a jazz festival that's part of the Aspen Music Festival and would start in the Benedict Tent the week before it opens? That was my whole idea at the outset was really to just be part of the music festival.
After a few meetings, Jazz Aspen Snowmass was born. Ramsey Lewis was one of the first people to play the festival. But after 2 years, it was struggling to make ends meet.
I was discouraged, and people around me were like, you know what, you should probably just move on. You should probably, you know, find another thing to do with your life, because it doesn't look like this is catching. And no one really here, it wasn't catching on. It was just a little thing, really. It's just a jazz concert over at the tent is all it was. Nobody really thought of it as anything any different.
But then the town of Snowmass Village came calling, asking if he wanted to have some shows there. It was the start of what's now the Jazz Aspen Snowmass Labor Day experience. First up, B.B. King.
The thrill is gone. The thrill is gone away.
And in the past few years, he's been able to get the nonprofit back to its roots, focusing on jazz as part of its mission. The JAS Cafe at the Little Nell brings world-renowned jazz musicians to an intimate venue where sometimes even Horowitz takes the stage.
I'm very, very excited about the future of that part of JAS and where it's going to go. And that's very exciting and very personal. You know, I'm gonna keep my finger right on it, and, you know, till I can't.
Until then, he'll continue to bring artists like Stevie Wonder, Ray Charles, Pancho Sanchez, and so many others to the Roaring Fork Valley. Patrick Fort, Aspen Public Radio News.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Barbara Platts.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. A panel of journalists join News Director Carolyn Zachariasen to provide analysis, insight, and commentary on the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.